I am Plata on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. In 2007, Richard Gwynne published the first volume of his biography of Sir John A. Macdonald, John A., The Man Who Made Us. He was on this program in the fall of that year to discuss the book, as he is now to discuss the second volume, Nation Maker, Sir John A. Macdonald, His Life, Our Times. It was published this past fall to great acclaim and many plaudits. The years covered in this book are 1867, the year of our Confederation, to 1891, the year of his death. The gift Mr. Gwynne has is he tells people's stories well. He makes Macdonald's life come alive on the page. The events of history are illustrated vividly and made understandable and accessible. The issues surrounding our founding, the scandals and controversies are parsed and analyzed with the hindsight of time and the context of contemporary references. It is a wonderful read and an absolutely important book. Richard Gwynne is an award-winning author and political columnist. He wrote widely praised biographies of Pierre Trudeau and Joey Smallwood, and his book, Nationalism Without Walls, one of my favorite books ever, was selected by the Literary Review of Canada as one of the 100 most important books about the country. RichardJGwynne.ca is the website for more. Nation Maker is published by Random House. I'm very pleased to welcome back to the Plata Online program Richard Gwynne. Good morning, Mr. Gwynne.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Not at all. Pleasure.
I've really enjoyed this book as well as the first book. So let's start at the beginning of this book. You dedicate the book to your father.
Yeah.
Did you ever talk to him about what he thought about Macdonald?
No. My father was Indian Army. That is the British Army of India. He wouldn't have ever heard of John A. Macdonald.
The books are compared to the Creighton books, obviously.
Yeah.
They're over 50 years old, I guess, when we last talked 4 years ago. You set out specifically to do a sort of your own version of a biography of Macdonald. What did you set out to do? I mean, there are things in this book that aren't in the Creighton books, obviously.
Oh, there's an awful lot. I'll tell you, and I'm not saying this because I'm in Vancouver, but there's a whole lot about the West. The West people in the mid-50s in central Canada paid very little attention to the West. And Creighton himself was not very interested or knowledgeable about the West. Not that I'm any expert on it. But I realized when I finished the book that the word West, except for and the and a few other words like that, the commonest word in it, in the book, is West. Often in the form of Northwest, which was the word then used, as you know, to describe the whole, now the prairies and British Columbia. But and then the whole question of Aboriginals, of Native people. Rio was not an important figure in Canada in the mid-50s. He was just being rediscovered. And of course today he's a major figure and he's a contemporary figure. And the whole Aboriginal question is a contemporary today issue. While people didn't think about it.
So we look at our country through the lens that we obviously have now, as opposed to the lens, say, that Creighton had. What do we understand about Canada once we've read these books of yours?
Well, I hope one thing people will understand is the argument I make, which is my core argument, that no Macdonald, and neither you nor I nor anybody listening to your program, would be a Canadian, is probably correct, almost certainly correct. I'm convinced it is correct. It's very hard because we're very successful now to realize how fragile, how almost absurd, let alone impossible, a country we were back in 1867. We were just a kind of bunch of leftover colonies of Britain that somehow clung together in order not to become America. But in 1867, all the people in Britain who knew something about Canada and all the people in the United States who knew something about Canada and weren't necessarily hostile to us. There were obviously quite a few people in America who believed in manifest destiny. But leaving that aside, these people took for granted we would soon disappear, that we would quickly become independent, because we were kind of half independent of 1867, but we weren't an independent country then, and that we would then go and join the United States, and the door was wide open, and there were a lot of Americans who, for various reasons, the most obvious being manifest destiny. It stretched all the way out to the Pacific, now go all the way up to the Arctic. And that's what everybody expected. And the handiest measure of how fragile a country we were back then is to go back to 1867. There's Quebec and Ontario, and then there's the two new provinces, Nova Scotia and New Brunswick. Nova Scotia, by far, the more important one. And that province held the first ever election as a province of Canada a few months out of Confederation, and simultaneously virtually took part in a federal election. That totaled 55 federal and provincial seats in Nova Scotia. Of those, 52, all but three, elected anti-Confederates committed to taking Nova Scotia out of the Confederation it had only entered 3 months earlier. That's how fragile and, you know, ephemeral we were.
And so what gift did MacDonald have in terms of, I mean, was it anti-Americanism? I mean, what
that was a, well, that's what he was anti-American. He genuinely believed, rightly or wrongly, that the British system of law, British system of politics, was far superior to the Americans, and the Americans, he always had a premonition, was going to come to grief. And, of course, it almost did in the terrible Civil War. But the two things that were going for this country was, one, the curious, stubborn refusal of most Canadians to become Americans. A great deal did become Americans by emigrating in those years, over a million, which is about a fifth of the population. But there was a real determination among ordinary Canadians, French, no different from English Canadians, not to become Americans. And MacDonald, who had the same utter conviction, and he was going to build a coast-to-coast nation so that we would have some coherence, some reality, as it were, with, you know, oceans on three sides and so on, and be as big as, quotation marks, the United States. But his great gift to us, he was an incredible politician. I mean, I make the claim that as a politician, not as a statesman, but he had some good ideas, but as a politician, he was up there with the best anywhere in the democratic world in the entire 19th century, by which I have in mind Abraham Lincoln and Benjamin Disraeli, Prime Minister of England. And in a sense, he was greater than either of them, because he was in a backward, underdeveloped, a runty colony on the edge of the civilized world, right extreme edge of the civilized world. And he had almost nobody to talk to. He had nobody, almost nobody who could say, "Sir John, I think that's a bad move, or why don't you try this," and so on. There were some smart people, but there weren't that many. And it was a very parochial, inward-grown society. And he had to do it all himself. And he did staggering things. I mean, we all know about the CPR. I mean, building that CPR was incredible, because he was building a railway about 2,500 miles to serve a market here in British Columbia of 25,000 people. That is financial lunacy, and yet he made it work. And by comparison, the first American transcontinental railway, which went Chicago, San Francisco, was serving a market of 1.5 million. So common sense said he couldn't do it, and yet he did it. And he was a brilliant politician. I can give you a whole string of examples, but he was of a class that is extraordinary for a small, and as I say, runty colony. And we were very lucky as a group of people to have had him running affairs during that period when we were weak and fragile and really didn't know what the hell being a Canadian was.
So, as you said, you've compared MacDonald. You say that he is a politician who's better than Disraeli or Lincoln. Do you think MacDonald has, if the people outside of Canada would be interested in someone like John A. MacDonald to read about, say?
Well, I hope so. I hope so. I mean, Canadian history isn't sexy. We didn't kill people. We didn't have revolutions and civil wars. We weren't bloodthirsty, and that and sex are the two things that attract you to read someone's history.
Right.
And ours was not of that order, of course. There were some incidents. There was, of course, the Rio Rebellion and so on, but not too much sex at any time. Well, that's not our strong point, at least in political terms. Our scandals are pretty pathetic compared, say, to the British ones and so on, sexual scandals. An intelligent person today in any country in the world would look at Canada and say, that is a very strange country because it has a policy of multiculturalism, which is about the future. I mean, the whole world is going to be multicultural. The whole world is global. And we are ahead of anybody. And we are doing, there are difficulties and there are challenges, of course there are, but we are doing better in dealing with multiculturalism and getting people from totally different cultures and backgrounds to become Canadian, to accept our way of doing things, better than any other country in the world. And the question is, how the hell do we do it? And one answer is, kind of attitude that means that we are one of the best, certainly among the developed countries, in terms of our financial system, in terms of the fact that our banks don't go bankrupt and say, bail me out. We have done some remarkable things. And at the moment, well, it's dangerous to get too cocky, and we'll have a fall, of course we will. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, we are doing extraordinarily well. How did it happen? How did this funny, I keep using the word runty colony, evolve into that? And this is a story that should appeal to a lot of people because they're trying to do the same thing. And we actually have something to say to people.
Now, when one thinks of McDonald, something that jumps to a lot of people's mind who may not know very much about McDonald is the drinking. There's a footnote in the book that people in this country at the time did drink, say, more than we do now. Did his drinking affect his judgment, say, for example, with how he handled the Rial situation or even with the Pacific scandal?
The Pacific scandal, yes. The Rial rebellion, not. Two things. One is drinking was very heavily, and getting drunk in public was not a shocking event. As the century went on, Canada became more and more Victorian, more and more proper, more and more respectable, and drinking started to fall out of fashion. But we were heavy drinkers well into the 20th century, and we drank far more than we do today, far more than we do now. For God's sake, at one reception at Government House, the residence of the Governor General in Ottawa, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada was blind drunk. You don't get that happening today. Things have changed enormously. McDonald was a binge drinker, an unusual kind of drinker. He might not drink at all for months, weeks, or often for months. And then he would go on a binge for various reasons. But he would go on a binge and be completely blotted for a week, 2 weeks. But one thing he did was to avoid deliberately making important decisions when he was drunk. He would know he was drunk, and he would avoid making decisions. He didn't do that during the Canadian Pacific scandal that you mentioned, and he got himself into real trouble. And he deserved the trouble. What he did was wrong, no question about it. With Rial, in the big Rial issue, which was, of course, the Saskatchewan Rebellion of 1885, McDonald had quit drinking. He quit drinking in the mid-70s, really out of shame and humiliation at the Canadian Pacific scandal. But he quit it. And after that, he would drink, as you and I and 90% of people do, socially. You have a couple of glasses of wine at the end of a day or a couple of bottles of beer, whatever it is. But it's under control. And he was like that. So he overcame his illness, and it was an illness, a sickness. But in the early years, before Confederation and for about 15 years after Confederation, he drank a lot.
And Agnes, Lady MacDonald, she didn't like the drinking, right?
Lady MacDonald, who was a devout Anglican, did all she could, and she did magnificently to cut him back. And she did succeed in cutting back. But what decided him to quit was the Canadian Pacific scandal. And it's kind of like, you know, it's very hard if you're an alcoholic to quit. And often with men, what causes them to quit is terror of losing their job. With a woman, it's losing the family, a breakup of the family. But with men, it's more the horror of losing the job. And in a sense, that's what McDonald was responding to.
Now, we're about to see our federal government and the provinces haggle over money and jurisdiction over health care. What can the leaders of today learn from the relations that McDonald had with his premiers at the time?
They weren't good.
No.
He fought with a lot of premiers. And for the first stint, that was 67 to 73, until he was pushed out by the Canadian Pacific scandal. Mm-hmm. He and the provinces got on well. But then as time went by, the provinces became cockier and more demanding, and he fought them because he didn't want power to implement policies. He was a very conservative man in many ways, but he did want power, authority to build a nation, and the provinces were challenging that from his point of view. And so there were big arguments between him and the provinces over distribution of powers. Ontario was then the one that was pushing the strongest for devolution of powers. And McDonald lost, but he lost not so much in Canada, he lost in Britain. We then referred all our constitutional and other big cases to Britain, to a thing called the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council. Mm-hmm. And it came down totally on the side of the provinces, without itself knowing a single thing about Canada. None of its members ever came to Canada. None of them knew anything about Canada. They specifically excluded any reference to Canadian law, Canadian debates, parliamentary debates, and all the rest of it. They simply made up their minds, and we took it. It was actually, you know, the odd thing is it's not thought of it that way, but it is. It was the most colonial-style, imperial-style intervention by Canada, by Britain in Canadian affairs during the height of the empire. And Canadians took it and didn't complain at all, basically because our lawyers and judges were so awed by the British legal system. That was a major factor. But anyway, we behaved like total colonials in that time.
Now, I've heard and read interviews that you've done for this book or since the fall, since the book came out, and they've asked you to compare MacDonald to other prime ministers. Trudeau is someone that you talk about in those comparisons. What about Mr. Harper? Is there anything that's like MacDonald and Harper?
MacDonald was a conservative, no question about it. Mind you, Canada generally was very conservative in those days. But he was a conservative. He was not an ideological conservative. He was a pragmatist. Whatever you do that works is what he was willing to do. And what he wanted to work for was to build Canada, turn Canada into a kind of would-be potential nation, into a real nation. And he managed. His phrase was that Canada needed time to harden from gristle to bone. And he was absolutely right in that. We did need time, and he won time for us.
But any comparison to Harper at all?
I'm not trying to dodge that, but they're not. I mean, Harper is obviously highly intelligent, and he's done extremely well. But what he lacks and what MacDonald had was contact with the people and love from the people. I mean, he, for instance, this is how, this goes back to how skilled a politician he was. He won three elections in the middle of a depression. There was a 25 plus year depression called the Long Depression through much of his term. Mm-hmm. And he still won elections. Normally, if things are bad, look at Barack Obama. If he doesn't pull unemployment down, he's a goner. But in those days, first of all, people didn't expect government to be able to create jobs for them. But secondly, MacDonald had such a connection to people. I mean, he was funny. I mean, you know, there's nothing to beat someone who in public who can be funny and genuinely funny and truly funny in the sense of not telling anecdotes which we can all polish up and nicely packaged and so on, but wit, which is spontaneous, unrehearsed. I mean, typical example. He's in Ontario talking to a bunch of farmers. He gets on a piece of farm machinery so he can better see them and they can see him. And somebody in the crowd says, "Sir John, do you know you're standing on a manure spreader?" McDonald thinks about this and he says, "This is the first time I've ever stood on the Liberal platform." I mean, that's why people liked him. He was one of them. He was a real guy. He wasn't a Democrat. He opposed the secret ballot. He opposed giving the ballot to everybody, that is to all men, which was the issue at the time, rather than only to those men who had property. He believed people who had property belonged to the system, would be more serious and sober and all those right things. But he was the most democratic leader we had, with the possible exception of Jean Chrétien. He could talk to anybody. He would come to anybody's backyard, and he would be completely at ease with them, and they would be completely at ease with him. He really was a natural Democrat.
Finally, the Globe and Mail review of this book called these two volumes that you've done, A Career Capper, I think, was the phrase. Do you look at it that way? I mean, these books...
Project I've ever undertaken. Yeah. It took me over 7 years for the two volumes, and I worked very, very hard during those 7 years. Mm-hmm. And I loved it, because I learned an awful lot. I could go on talking, as you can tell. I apologize. But... it was fascinating. I mean, how that man created a country out of almost nothing, and how that country then proceeded, and much of it because of him in different ways. I mean, of course, the Northwest Mounted Police, mm-hmm. in the West. The West in Canada was totally different from the West in the United States. Here it was peace, order, and good government. There it was the gun. It was vigilante justice. And that was because of the Northwest Mounted Police that he created, and that he originally wanted to be what he called a co-mingling of the races, English Canadians, French Canadians, Métis, Indians. Beautiful idea, impossible to implement because of the troubles with Riel. But that was the kind of way he built this nation, and that was our first distinctively Canadian institution. And in those days, if somebody said to you, what the hell is a Canadian? Because, you know, you're all ex-British and all Anglo-Saxons, which we all were then, except, of course, French Canadians, mm-hmm. and so similar to Americans. You could say, we're the kind of guys who have something like the Northwest Mounted Police, and nothing like it has ever existed in the United States.
Did you like the movie, the John A. movie?
Oh, I loved it. I loved it. It was based on part of Vol 1, it was a superb job. I mean, it is human, it is real. You understand people arguing about this and that, maneuvering political backroom behavior. It's all based on fact. And by the way, to use your program as a plug,
yeah.
I think it would be a terrible, terrible, terrible shame if the CBC, which has only run one program, it should have run a series on all the pre-Confederation things,
right.
And it should now, and it's not to flog my book, it's because there's so much good material in what happened in those days that will tell us about where we came from. And the benefit of knowing where you came from is you have a better idea of where you should go.
Perhaps something with regards to the bicentennial.
Well, that is, you're absolutely right. I mean, the bicentennial, as you know, is 2015, mm-hmm. 200th anniversary of his birth in Glasgow, Scotland. And to have a real series, because a single program on television with millions of channels, it's almost impossible to promote and for anybody to stumble upon it except by accident. But a series builds up, and that really was an absolutely first-class, the man who deserves credit. His name is Bernie Zuckerman. He's a very good drama documentary maker and documentary maker. Mm-hmm. And the actor who played John A., Sean Doyle, was just superb. And I hope to God the CBC has the nous and wit and imagination to commission a series.
Indeed. These are a magnificent couple of books. Congratulations on a very fine achievement, Richard, and all the best.
Thank you very much. You've been very kind. I enjoyed it immensely.
The book is called Nation Maker, Sir John A. Macdonald, His Life and Times, 1867 to 1891. It's published by Random House. Do pick up the first volume if you haven't. It's just great reading. Richard Gwynn on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plantum.